is upon us. Oh, this one needs to be turned on.
Hello. Okay, this one's working. I'll use this one.
So Christmas time is upon us, which means that everything that you see, everywhere you look around, there's two kind of general narratives, two general characters that are super prevalent. As you can see up here, and as you look around, you'll probably be able to see this. It's Santa and the Nativity. And these two things are being put out there everywhere. And obviously, as Christians, we've got a certain... We believe very strongly in why the nativity scene is so much more compelling, why it's so much more important. But not everybody sees like that. And every year, the skeptics come around, and I see across my Facebook feed, or I see on wherever I happen to be on, or hear personally from friends that aren't Christians, and talk about how the claim is that these two are basically exactly the same. They said, and obviously as Christians, we couldn't say it further from the truth. And it's kind of an offensive thing to say as a, you know, Christian being told that these two things are exactly the same. But this year I've decided, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to step back and try to put aside my offense to this accusation and say, let's just say for a second that we approach an atheist that is making these claims, saying Santa Claus and the Nativity are basically the same. The claim is that both of them are here simply to provide a carrot, to provide some kind of motivation for behavioral change. And let's take that and let's play with it for a second. And can we take somebody that doesn't believe in supernatural, that doesn't believe in heaven, and can we take the story of the Nativity and say, this is why it's fundamentally different? And so I started playing around with that a little bit, looking at those two stories, and what I came up with is that at their essence, they're both about the nature of motivation. Why do we do what we do? And as I was looking at this, the more and more I came to see that social science, which is kind of one thing that I really love looking into, is, and so we're going to be spending a little bit of time on that. I hope you don't mind. But social science is starting to show more and more through study that the way that Jesus operates is incredibly different than anything else that we've seen in the past, and that the old ways of doing things simply aren't good. And yet, for 2,000 years, Jesus has come along and has motivated us and done things and shown us ways that modern science is just now starting to discover, and modern businesses are starting to realize are revolutionizing the way that they do things. And so we're going to look into that for a second. And we want to see what it says about Jesus' actions. And what we're going to find here, which I think is so interesting, is that this all shows, this is a huge conversation I'm trying to boil down in a very short period of time. So there will be little gaps as I'm trying to like fly through this. But we're going to see for a second why the early church took off so incredibly fast. Why some of us may struggle with connecting with God, why we struggle with changing habits, i.e. the sermon title, and why we may have struggled with evangelism in the past, but most importantly, what makes the Christian church so powerful that the world doesn't seem to understand? Why would a little fledgling group of people that were persecuted for what they believe, why did it grow so quickly into this massive movement? And I think that this is all a really wonderful thing. So here we go. I'm going to go ahead and say, first of all, a lot of what I'm going to be talking about this morning is coming from this book. So if this topic is interesting to you, I definitely suggest picking this up. It's a great read if you're into social science. Just a warning, it's not a Christian perspective. That's kind of my take on everything that he's saying. But anyways, check it out if this is something that's interesting to you. So it's written by this guy named Daniel Pink, and he suggests that there's three basic motivators that motivate us as people. We're going to jump into those in a second. So the first one is motivation 1.0. And as you can see from the picture here, motivation 1.0 is the most basic level of motivation. I've got a bear chasing me, must run to survive. From an evolutionary standpoint, which is where he's coming from, he says, okay, this is the most primitive way of doing things. And you can still see this in, you know, basic things that you do. We were talking about, you know, skydiving or bungee jumping or anything like that. You go to the edge of this thing and every piece of your fiber, every piece of your being screaming out, no, don't do it, this is dangerous. That's motivation 1.0. It's at its core basis, just survival. And then we have motivation 2.0 come along. And this is what we can see society, most of all, being built upon. And the easy way to say this is just, it's a carrot and it's a stick reward, right? You do good, you get rewarded, you get your carrot, good job. You do bad, you get punished. And I wanted to spend some time talking about this because this is much of the way that we build our society. And also, spoiler alert, strongly shapes the way that we see our relationships and impacts our relationship with God. So this is often the primary method of parenting. You know, we've all been there. Things are going well. We motivate with good, right? In the end, everyone's happy. How often per week, maybe I say it too often, is like, be good and we'll go get ice cream. And I want them to be good because I want ice cream. It's that carrot, right? But when they aren't good, what happens? And especially when your patience runs out as parents, like we all like to say, pretend like we are, you know, perfect and this never happens. But I think there's times for all of us when that patience runs a little bit too thin and it becomes a little bit closer to like a hostage scenario. You know what I mean? Like, you kind of do this whole like, all right, Jaden, listen up here, buddy. You do that one more time and Fluffy gets it. You know, there's the stick, right? Like, don't do this again or you will regret it. And for society, oftentimes it usually comes more with the stick, right? The carrot, your motivation is simply you obey all the rules, you say all the right things, you obey the traffic laws, you do, you know, everything you're supposed to do, you don't do what you're supposed to do, and you get to live in a relatively safe and predictable environment. When people don't act that way is when it becomes unreliable and unsafe. And then the stick is, of course, when you get to a red light less than half a second too late and the friendly Gotcha Camera 3000 takes a nice picture of you, sends you a paper-thin stick in the mail. I am not speaking from personal experience on this one, I swear. Nor am I bitter. But that's their stick, right? Like, they're going to send you your ticket, and off you go. It's the carrot and the stick. And for many years, the workplace has operated like this, too. Hey, you want a bonus? You want that Christmas bonus? You want a larger amount of money? Show the numbers. Show that you've been selling more. Show that you're more efficient, doing better in some way. You want to keep your job? Show the numbers. Show the stick. It's that carrot and the stick. And the problem with this, kind of, you see, that there's no way that you can completely get rid of this, but the problem with it in general is when it's your only tool, it's kind of, well, primitive a little bit. Think about it. This is how you train an animal. This is how you train your dog. Sit, Fido. Good boy. Here's a treat. Right? Or dog pooped inside again. Bad dog. Here's a punishment. That's how you train an animal. And so when we use this method alone, it's basically treating somebody like your basic animal situation, right? You just want control over the situation. It's good for modifying behaviors, but it does some particularly damaging things, and it's often not sustainable. Here's what often happens when you use this carrot and you stick only. You get decreased performance, you get decreased motivation, and you get decrease in ethical thinking. So when you approach somebody from just this, do what I want you to, either reward or punishment-based system, you only get what you, you don't, the long term, that's what I'm trying to say, the long term is generally not what you're wanting. There is a study that was done, and some economists from some of the U.S. top colleges set up an experiment. I love this part. They set up an experiment using 87 volunteers. And what they did is they asked them to play some seemingly meaningless games and puzzles. Some were like throwing a ball into a basket, or some were like solving some puzzles or memory games or something like that. And they divided the groups up into three groups. And so the first group, they gave a small reward for winning. They say, you win, here's a little bit of money. The next group, they gave a medium reward, which roughly equaled 2 weeks of pay, which I think is a little bit more medium, but sure. Like half a month's pay. And they say, you win, you'll get a half month's pay. And then the last group of people, and this is great, the last group of people, they gave nearly 5 months of pay to win this silly little memory game, or to win this ball throwing contest, or whatever it may be. And of course, the idea being, can we seriously motivate somebody based on how big the motivator is? And so here's what they discovered. The small reward group and the medium reward group performed the exact same. So just a small token number versus 2 weeks performed the exact same. The difference in pay there did not provide any extra motivation whatsoever. Now here's the clincher. You ready? The large reward group, these people, 5 months of pay worth. A sizable amount of money to get it. You'd think that they'd be super motivated to want to get this done. But they performed at the bottom of the group. At the absolute bottom, scored worst of all. And in 8 out of 9 tasks, they were the absolute worst. 8 out of 9 tasks. This is very predictable, very repeatable. And there have been several studies that have gone over this one again, showing that the larger amount doesn't necessarily produce better results. Very interesting. And it doesn't necessarily mean that giving money as a motivator is bad, but what we're seeing is that the shift in motivation is it. Because all of a sudden, when the shift in motivation is just the money, I have to evaluate whether that money is worth it. We're going to see that in another example coming up here. It also destroys creativity. There were several studies that were done recently that were looking at artists' work, and they brought them before professional art critique people. And they showed them these artists' work. And what they did is, predictably, over and over and over again, when somebody showed a piece of art that somebody did just for their own gratification versus what they showed them, what they were paid to do, predictably, over and over, the one that were, they were paid to do was not as good. And it's diminishing returns. Every single time you do it, often when you pay, I think a lot of us as parents have seen this a little bit when we try this with, like, you know, clean up your room, son, I'll get a dollar. You'll get a dollar. And first it's like, okay, I'll go clean my room for a dollar. Next time around, yeah, okay. Third time around, I'm not really sure it's worth a dollar. Do you have two? And now they want more, and they start bargaining for more and more and more, and they start looking at this reward, constantly critiquing, is this worth my time? Is this worth my energy? And generally what happens is you get as little out of that person as possible to avoid the stick or get the reward, right? So that's why we're looking, that's why you have a syllabus, right? When you're going into a class and they show you, like, what are the things that you're doing? And you're constantly analyzing, going, okay, what's the least I can get by with and still get my reward? What's the least I can get by with and not get punished? And so that's what generally happens. And only works as long, this only works as long as somebody is scared of the stick or enticed by the carrot. And generally, the longer somebody has this carrot dangling in front of them, the less enticing it becomes. And the more you've got somebody threatening, the less threatening they become. So there's one more example. There was a Swedish study that was done. And this is kind of revolving around the debate as to whether or not we should pay somebody to donate blood. And so there's a Swedish study that was done, and they divide this group of people, once again, into three groups. The group one was voluntary. They say, you're not getting a dime for this. We're just happy you're here. Would you give us your blood? Group two, they say, we'll give you a small token amount of money. to give us your blood. Like, see, it's worth your time. We're paying you for this. It's worth it. Here, would you donate your blood? And then group three said, okay, we will give you the same amount of money. However, when we give you this money, we would really like you to donate it back to this children's charity. Would you be willing to do that? And here's what they found. Group one, these are the people that were given no external motivation. They were given no monetary value for what they were doing. Group one, 52%, or just over half of the people, said, yeah, I'll give you money. So this is, or I'll give you money. I'll give you blood in exchange for nothing, just because I feel like it's the right thing to do. And so that's what they did. Group two, these were the ones that were given money. So like we've got group that's given no money at all, and then group two that's given money. Now you would predict that like, okay, I give you a reward, more people would want to do this. Guess what? 30% said they would donate. Significantly reduced the amount of people willing to donate blood when they offered them a monetary incentive. Isn't that interesting? So it's like, give money just because it's the right thing to do, or give money, I keep on saying that. Give blood just because it's the right thing to do, and over half were like, yeah. Give blood because we'll give you money, and they're like, nope, we're out, not enough money, sorry, bye. Now here's the thing, group three, the ones that say, we'll give you money, however, we'd really like it if you gave your money back to a charity, exact same as group one. 52%. And so what we're seeing, and here's the point, is that giving blood is not about what you can get in return. Giving blood is about doing the right thing. The major motivator for giving blood is simply that you want to give back to the world. You want to do the right thing. You want a morally, you want to be motivated by high moral standards. And as soon as you introduce the opportunity to get money for it, it removes that motivation and no longer about doing this because it's the right thing. It becomes doing it about money, and that money is not enough. Very interesting. So I want to go back to this. And I see two very different motivators here. Don't believe me? Let's go with this. You better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. That's right. You better not, because Santa Claus is coming to town. He's making a list, and he's checking it twice. He's going to find out who's naughty and nice. Why? Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees you when you're sleeping. Not creepy at all. He knows when you're awake. He knows when you've been bad or good, so be good. For goodness sakes, if that's not a carrot and stick situation, I don't know what is. This is motivation 2.0 incarnate. You've got this, you do the right thing, you get your presents. You do the wrong things, and you get coal. So you better do the right things. Here's the thing, though, is that as we've seen, that carrot and that stick motivator doesn't work very well, in the long run at least. Maybe it does for a little bit. And so you may be thinking, why on earth are we still getting coal in our stocking? It's because this punishment and this reward scenario simply isn't very compelling. Here's something from the book. People often use rewards expecting them to inspire productivity, but often they end up undermining the far superior drive of intrinsic motivation. Intrinsic motivation being motivation that's inspired from your heart because of what you want to do. And so when you bring along an external motivator, a lot of times what you end up doing is turning off the internal motivator and saying, oh, I want to do this because it's the morally right thing to do. Oh, I want to do this because it's fun. I want to do this for any of these other reasons. You turn that off when you turn on an external. Pink says, this is the most significant find of social science and the most ignored. one more quote. What science is revealing is that carrots and sticks can promote bad behavior. So not only does it not do good things, it actually promotes bad behavior. The more often you provide rewards, the more often you provide punishments, it actually promotes bad behavior. It creates addiction and promotes short-term thinking at the expense of a long view. So if you're still getting coal for Christmas, so to speak, if your behaviors aren't changing and you so desperately want them to, and you're not sure why, maybe it's because you're relying too heavily on those external things. Why isn't somebody punishing me for this? Why isn't somebody, what are people going to think, right? We say that a lot. What are people going to think? Well, truth is, what people are going to think isn't the strongest motivator. What's the strongest motivator is what drives you, what you want. And so I think sometimes when we look way back on the ways that we evangelize, the way that we look at evangelism and bring people to God, we often see, when we go further and further and further back, we see a very strong carrot and stick motivator, right? There's that famous John Edwards sermon, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." Wow, what a stick, right? What a stick. We're going to come along and you're going to burn in hell forever. Bang, 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 bang. Isn't that scary? Come to Jesus so that you don't get this punishment. And can you imagine what happened when Adventists came along and we're like, yeah, you know what? Hell isn't actually a place where you're going to suffer forever. And they're like, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're taking away the one reason that everybody comes to church is because they're terrified of hell. You're taking that away. You're taking away the motivator. You're taking away the big stick. What are you going to do? Are you nuts? That's kind of the way that a lot of people saw this theology of hell, the way that we present it, is they were terrified that we're undermining the very foundations of why people would want to come to church, why people would want to support, why people would come to Jesus. And they had this carrot of heaven. But honestly, that's not compelling to a lot of people, especially if it's not on the other side of an eternal structure, eternal hell. And so my very humble suggestion on this is, let's not take evangelistic advice from Santa. He doesn't get it, as I have demonstrated. I have something else to present to you, a different motivator. Here's the other side of the story. You talked about motivation 2.0, which was Santa. Now this is what Pink calls motivation 3.0. And if you don't believe me, I just want to take a second and go in to a text for a bit. And I want you, as I'm reading through this, I want you to see if you can hear the carrot, right? The motivator, or the stick, which is the punishment. And this is the words of Jesus. He says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, because they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for there is the kingdom of heaven." So I'm going to ask you, where's the carrot and the stick in that? There's lots of blessings, but for what? In order to have a carrot, in order to have a motivator, you have to have something that you perform first. If you do this, then I will give you this. But as Jesus is speaking, he's saying, you are blessed right now, not because of what you do, but you are blessed. And he even goes as far as to say that people that are suffering are blessed. There's nothing that you do to gain that. He's saying, you are blessed, and we will make you blessed. It's not this, do this and you will be rewarded. These are not commands, but they are invitations for holiness. You see the difference? It's not do this and you'll get this. This is not an exchange. This is saying this is the blessing of holiness. This is the blessing of following me. Completely devoid of any demands. Much, much different take. Jesus came to this earth and he sacrificed first. He sacrificed first. This is not transactional. What Santa offers is not really a gift. It's a transaction. You have to earn it. But what Jesus offers is given, not because of anything that you do, but because of who he is and because of what he has done. And it's a gift that he offers first. And all he says is, take it. Take it. There is a very, very different motivational system out there. Motivation 3.0, it's intrinsic. It comes from you. It comes from conviction. It comes from the interests that you have. It comes from the play that you do. I worked with a pastor once, and he used to talk about this story. And I don't know what event it was, but it was some kind of event where they had, he was in charge of a group of volunteers setting up, it was a large stadium of some kind. And he said they were late all night long setting up the stage. And they're at this giant stadium where the people that worked there in one group and the people that were volunteering for the church in another group. And he said at the end of the night, the guy in charge of his crew came up and said, your people worked twice as hard as mine all night long. They didn't complain. They didn't ask for more. They didn't even ask for breaks. What is your secret on this? And Ed, his pastor, says, my secret is that I don't pay them. And the guy goes, what? And he says, these people are here because they believe in what we're doing. They're working hard because they believe in what they're doing. Your guys are here because they want to earn a paycheck, and they get paid the exact same amount if they do less. My people are here because they want to see the mission accomplished. That is motivation 3.0. The last thing I want to talk about this is the carrots and sticks set up a power dynamic. One can reward and one can punish. You cannot set up a system of rewards and punishment without me saying, I have power over you. I have power over you to give you a reward. I have power over you to give you a punishment. But motivation 3.0, the motivation that God sits on, it honors the person. It indicates that you have inherent value to bring to the table through your passions and through your creativity. Jesus had every right to take the position of authority and say, you do this and you get punished. You do this and you get rewards. But instead, he says, follow me by your own free will, and you can leave anytime you want. But I want you, this is what God is saying, like, I want you to see the value in what we're doing. And I want you to be here because you believe in this, not because you're scared of punishment. That is the major difference. And I love that. Those of you that are familiar with the Adventist sanctuary doctrine and the teaching on that, we see a God that is not looking out for every punishable wrong, but a God that is actively advocating for us. He's not out looking for, like, how he can zap us because we're doing wrong, but we see a God that's actively saying, I want them here. I want them redeemed. And if you aren't familiar with the sanctuary doctrine, let me know. It's a beautiful teaching, and I or many other here would love to talk to you about it because it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. And major companies, and here's the thing that I'm kind of circling around to, major companies are experimenting with models that play more towards this higher model of motivation, of encouraging exploration. And it's like completely turning the world upside down because they're saying, what we're going to do is we're going to intentionally cut out the efficiency of our model to give people the autonomy to play. Why would you do that? Like, in any normal circumstance, that seems ridiculous. Here's what we're finding. 3M, they're one of the ones that started it. They suggested to their staff that they take 15% of their time to just work on a side project, any side project. We're not going to monitor what you do. Just go have fun, play around, see what you can do. 15% of their money just gone on people playing. That's what the accountants all thought, right? But here's what ended up happening. What came out of that is Post-it notes. Because somebody was playing around one day and thought, what if I made a piece of paper that had a ridiculously weak adhesive on it? And you just put it all around. 3M is making a fortune on that. Why? Because they decided to let their people play and honor who they were as engineers. Google uses 20% of their time, and they say, just go, play, think of something new. See what you can come up with. Work on whatever you want to work on. This is completely unmonitored time. Guess what? Typically near the typical year, at the end of the year, half of its products, half are because somebody was developing something in this 20% playtime. This 20% playtime is where the productivity happens, not where it drops off, because they were giving people the opportunity to just play. And I believe that this is the power of church. We are a group of people motivated by a deep sense of conviction of what our motivation is. This is a ripe environment for passions to be developed and celebrated, and creativity to be developed and separated. Think about this. How many places do you see people just showing up to work just because they're not getting a dime? So often recently, I've seen Kevin here late in the church painting the back. Doesn't it look great? He's not getting paid for that. He's just doing it because he cares about the church. This is something that he wants to do, to serve. Isn't that wonderful? This is what we do here. I love seeing little Violet up here banging on the drum. How many places do you get to see somebody just saying, hey, kids, come on up, make some noise with us? Isn't that wonderful? Greeters at the door, people just spending their time just saying hello. Why? Because that's something they enjoy doing, watching somebody walk in the door. These are times where we say, go explore your passions, explore your giftedness, take what you love doing and use it to serve. That is the power of the church, and I love it. This is a place that you can fully embrace those things. This is also brings to mind an anxiety that I hear a lot as a pastor. And this is this anxiety of like, but pastor, what does God want, right? Like, I don't know if I should make this move or not. I don't know if I should take this job or not. I don't know what college I should go to. What am I supposed to do? I just want to hear a sign from God. And I want you to think about this for just a second, and let's ask, what if that's intentional on God's part? What if he's not giving you an answer on that? What if he wants us to feel that autonomy? We spend all of our time just saying, what does God want? What if he wants us to make that decision? What if he wants our energies put into seeking him and not seeking the course of our life? He says, what if he's calling us to seek holiness, to seek our relationship with him? And he's like, you know what? You go, man. You make the decision that you think you need to make, and I will go with you. And every once in a while, I think that God intervenes, and he comes in, and he's like, ah, yeah, actually stay away from that one. But more often than not, he lets us make those decisions because he knows that he's going to go with us. We're going to be able to serve wherever we go. And as long as we are doing that with God, it doesn't even matter where we are because we're going to be a light wherever we go. Continue to follow him and be comfortable with the autonomy that he has given you. Be confident in your decision-making, knowing that he's given you the right to do that. So, once again, I want to go back to this. What's the differences? On the left, we see the carrots and sticks. We see motivation, remember, manipulation, power structures. And on the right, with Jesus, we have free will, autonomy, invitation, self-sacrifice on Jesus' part. Those are the differences. When somebody comes along and says, these are the only things, these are like Santa and Jesus, they're the exact same. Rather than be offended, you can come back and say, no, they're very different. Very different, because we got very different motivations. And so I want to bring it home by asking three questions. The first question is, how do you see God in your life? Do you see him running with motivation 2.0 or motivation 3.0? How do others see God through you, and why do we do what we do? So the first question, how do you see God in your life? Which of those two images best represents God in your mind? When you think about God, does he look more like the Santa that watches you like the CIA? He's calculating your every move, determining your worthiness, and steps into your world with the sole motivation of judging you. If you've been good enough, you may get your reward. And we all know that that's not the right one. However, sometimes pre-programming kicks in, doesn't it? I would venture to guess that some of you, maybe even a lot of you, grew up with the image of a punitive God, and you may have a hard time shaking that idea. You may have grown up with this idea that God is watching out for you and you need to be scared of him. And that might be a hard thing for you to shake. And I invite you to spend your time, spend some real time to see God differently. See a God that is not wanting to exert power and authority, but willing to be subjected to our sinfulness, coming here as a baby in the most vulnerable way possible. That's just not something that somebody that's so concerned with authority would do. Second question, how do others see God through you? The initial way people see God is through us. And it's intimidating. It's super intimidating, I know. But if they see people that are more interested in control, power dynamics, carrots and sticks, that's how they're going to see God. And that's how they're going to understand God. And this includes your kids. Now, for a second, I want to step back. This does not mean that you ignore actions and consequences. This is not what I'm saying. Actions and consequences will always exist. But the difference is, I think, understood by really good teachers. And I think good teachers are who have shown me what these differences are. For those of you who have been to college, we all know those professors that you just tell the answer that they're looking for, right? You go in and you're like, okay, this is what they're looking for. I'm just going to say that. And you always get your A because it's very clear that they are the overlord of your grade. That's the way they do things, right? But a good teacher will come alongside you and say, I am your partner. I am your coach through this process. Struggling with calculus, I'm going to be there to help you understand this well enough to conquer this subject. You're not conquering me. You're conquering the subject, and we're partners in understanding that. That's the difference. And I think if we as parents can start doing that and getting our kids to understand, the goal is for you to become a good human being, and I am your partner in that. Your goal is not to kowtow to me. It's not to try to get to make me happy with you. It's for us to grow you as a person, and we're partners in this. And I will do everything that I can to help you do that. And lastly, why do we do what we do? If you're able to answer that question for any given task, it does a lot for you. Maybe you're in a job that you used to love and you just can't seem to get out of bed anymore for, right? Fallen into the trap of doing it strictly for the benefits that you've been given. I want you to think a little bit about why you did this in the first place. At home, nothing ever seems to get done. You ask your family member till you're blue in the face. Nicely, not nicely. Bribery, nothing seems to work. Nobody seems to listen to you. If that's the case, maybe you have teenagers. Jokes aside, though, maybe you've been relying on the carrot and stick thing for too long. Shift the concentration to something internal, something meaningful. We are in this together. We all live in this house together. Let's make it something worth living in. Maybe you're struggling to do your personal devotion time. Maybe just to eke out a few minutes of the day to set aside in prayer. And maybe you've forgotten what made it meaningful in the first place, and that's why you're struggling to get it done. Learn to fall. My admonition to you is learn to fall in love with God again. Go back to the place where that time in prayer was comforting and grounding and meaningful and even necessary. We tend to look at failing spiritual life and we beat ourselves up for it. We say, oh, you've fallen behind. You're not good enough. God's going to be mad at you. Whatever it may be. And I want to say, let go of that guilt. It's not doing you any good. That's the care. That's the stick that you're beating yourself up with. You're punishing yourself for nothing. And it's easy to drift sometimes, to forget why you do what you do. And that's why the church has so many mechanisms built in to why, to remind us why. Maybe you're struggling in the area that you're serving in here. I found in times of ministry when I get frustrated, when I get angry, it's usually because I've forgotten why I do what I do. And when I find myself in those moments where I'm just like, nothing's work, all the programs I'm doing are not working out, and people aren't responding the way I want to, and all those other things, I will schedule out a huge portion of my time, all of it if I can, and just start visiting people. And it doesn't take long with sitting with struggling people, with listening to the voices of the teenagers and the widows and the working people and people that are struggling, people that have lost spouses or anything else, to sit down with those people and cry with them and listen to them and pray with them, to realize this is why I'm here, not to push forward this program, but to sit with people and share faith. That's why we're here. And if you are in a position in the church right now that you're struggling with, that you're not really sure why you're here, what you're doing, or if you're walking through those doors going, I am not even sure why I'm here, I invite you to reevaluate what this used to mean to you at some point in time. Look around you. Maybe God is calling you through that to start something that will feed your soul and it also feeds somebody else's. This is the motivation. This is why we do what we do. And this is what makes the church so formidable, because we're here following deep conviction. I don't know where you've been, but if you find yourself thinking about the world, others, especially God, in terms of carrots and sticks, I invite you to refocus. See God for who he is, or maybe see yourself for who God sees. There's nothing more beautiful, nothing more compelling than a heart moved by gratitude for God's undeserved grace and love. My prayer for you all is that you can experience that. There's just nothing better. Let's pray. Lord God, thank you for being that for us. God, thank you for knowing us well enough to know that unlike all the other things in our world around us, unlike all the other religions, all the other gods presented at the time, whatever they may be, you came in and said, I'm not going to punish and reward, but I'm going to invite you to a higher place because of what I've already done, not because of what you can earn. Lord, we love you so much for that. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Amen.